Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're bringing you a little program today about mostly about beverages.
Some kind of different ones.
Yeah.
You might be sure we'd find different ones, right?
What do you mean?
Well, we always find different ones.
Oh, well, yes. I mean, the first one up, though, is Niven Family Wines.
Well, that again is somewhat unusual because the wineries are in the Paso Robles region, which is only, an entrant into the California wine stakes of the last 20 to 30 years.
Yeah, but we've always liked them.
Yeah, we have, and so when we sampled these, we really enjoyed them, and we enjoyed talking to the
Christian
winemaker.
Rogno.
And here he is. Probably not surprising, listeners, that the first question we wanted to ask Christian Roganant of Niven Family Wines in California, why he came to the United States to make wine instead of staying home in France.
Well, I had a very unique opportunity back in the early 80s. I was working in Champagne in France in a small town of Épernay, which is famous for Champagne. And the Champagne House called Champagne Dutz decided to invest in the United States and start producing a sparkling wine in California, to be more precise, in Arroyo Grande, which is halfway between Los Angeles and San Francisco, pretty much exactly halfway, just a couple of miles from the ocean. And I came on board to California in 1986 to help with winemaking and create the best sparkling wine we could make from Californian vineyards.
Now, you said when I asked you this question just a few minutes ago, you said there was another reason you were looking to make your fortune elsewhere, and that is that getting a job as a winemaker in France is pretty tough.
Well, yes, there is a number of things. It's unfortunately, being a winemaker in France is not as prestigious as being into the United States. Generally, and it's pretty much the same all over Europe, the person that gets the most fame within a winery is the owner. The winemaker is important, but is someone that is, less prominent, versus in the United States, it's kind of the reverse. The owner generally is take a step back, and the winemaker is not, direct, obviously, the production, but becomes more the spokesperson and, represents more the winery and the wines.
Sure. The owner provides one particularly important ingredient, right? In this country, it's black on one side and green on the other.
Money. Money.
So, but it's not a way, I understand, that you make a lot of money. So the Nivens must have been a little crazy, too.
Tell us about the family.
Well, the Niven family, they have a fascinating history. The grandfather and his wife, Jack Niven and Catherine Niven, were in the grocery stores in the 30s, 40s, 50s. They used to have a very large chain of supermarkets in California called Purity. And in fact, they have close to 165 stores during the peak of their success. And the stores were basically from San Luis Obispo all the way to the Oregon border. And the Purity lines of supermarket was very successful. And as some newcomers came on board, the Vons, Albertsons, and Pavilions, and Ralphs, and so many of them, they really had two options, either way to get out of the industry or go public, raise a lot of money, and become a very, very large company. And they decided, since they were more family business, and that was really what they had in mind, they decided to liquidate the business. But when you have so many stores, it took 20 to 30 years.
Oh, wow.
And as they were doing the getting out of the industry, Jack Niven, being a true visionary, decided to, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, to plant a vineyard.
Okay.
And he not only planted a vineyard, he planted a vineyard in a place that didn't at that time have a whole lot of vineyards either. So we'll talk a little bit more about Paso Robles and the Central Coast and that in a little bit, but that was pretty much of a bold thing to do at that time, was it not?
Yes, absolutely. So what Jack Niven did, being a very detailed person, what he did, he hired the Professor Winkley, which is a very famous professor at the University of Davis in the early 70s, and also hired the professor from Fresno. And independently, He asked them, please fly over California, explore all the different valleys, and please come back to me and make me a proposal of where I should consider planting grapes, where would be a new place that nobody has ever planted grapes, where would that place be? And they all came with different valleys and different options. And surprisingly was that Etna Valley was actually mentioned by both of those professors. So he said if both Mr. Jack Niven thought, well, if both see one valley, it couldn't be that bad. So he went ahead in 1972, planted, purchased 600 acres, and the following year planted them.
Wow.
Now, it's interesting. Other people have followed his lead. Was he the first? Was he the first to plant in that area, or was he just one of the early planters?
Well, there has been a lot of different planting over the years. The first planting came from in 1772 by the missionary that planted the mission grape in San Luis Obispo for the mission. And then in the 1800s, about 15 miles from the ocean, they planted, Zinfandel was planted, and it's in 1973, two people actually planted into the Etna Valley. One of them was the Niven family, and the other family was Chamisol.
Now, the area has now become very, very popular, and there's a group of characters. They call themselves the Rhone Rangers.
Rangers,
who are planting grapes that their family was growing back in southern France, and they decided to do the same thing as the Niven family did, and I guess they've been very successful too.
Yes, indeed. I don't recall who was the first person planting vineyards, but I know Gary Eberle, one of the first he planted also grapes in the 70s. And you have to remember that back then in the 70s and 80s, more than 95% of the fruit produced into the Arroyo Grande, Etna Valley and Paso Robles would go to Napa Valley for the blends.
Oh yeah,
right. So it wasn't respected for its own character, but you have obviously since discovered that in fact it is a particularly good region for growing grapes, and the Rhone Rangers and some of their fellows have proved that as well. But you've done something different in my limited knowledge of having explored what you're doing. You're growing grapes, you're growing Cabernet Sauvignon, which of course everybody in California grows, but you're growing two other white wine grapes called Grüner Veltliner and, what's the other one, Albarino. And,
yes.
And they are most certainly not frequently planted in the United States. So why?
Well, the United States is and its customers, wine consumers, are fairly new to the world of wine, and you know they drink what they know, and the most four main varietals that most Americans drink are today Cabernet, Chardonnay, I guess Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, maybe five with Pinot Grigio. So when you introduce a new varietal such as Grüner Veltliner or Albarino, It's something unknown. People are changing their view on the world now. They're more willing to try new things. But when you look at 10, 20, 30 years ago, if you had on a wine list of varietals that nobody has ever heard of, they don't know where it's from, and they don't know how to pronounce the name, it would be suicidal or very challenging for a winery to try to plant a lot of those particular grapes, knowing that it would be very difficult to sell them. And even though now there is Grüner and Albarino planted in the States, the planting of those varietals is extremely small. For instance, there is 115 acres of Grüner Veltliner planted in the state versus 100,000 of Chardonnay. Albarino today in production represent 195 acres. So those acreage are extremely small compared to the enormous planting of a Cabernet, Chardonnay, those other varietals.
Well, these would fit into the the other wine that's popular in California, which they call ABC.
Anything but
Chardonnay. So they would fit very, very well into that category. But was there something that you needed to learn in order to be successful making wine with these grapes, which
well,
are distinctly
the following? Learning process is fairly simple. You, in the case of Albariño, went to Spain, and I had been to Spain when I was living in Europe. People are very open, so you can, you know, talk to 15, 20 growers and wineries. It's in Galicia in Spain, and they'll tell you everything, what's unique about growing Albariño, the challenges to make the wine. Same thing with Bruno Wettlin along the Danube River, in the Wachau, in the Kemptal, Transental. You can go to those regions and find out a lot of information. So you come back from Europe, and then you really have a lot of knowledge to be successful with those new varietals, even though you have not a lot of experience. But you can start up with a pretty good level. It's almost like if you're an English speaker and you go to England, but if you study for a while English, and when you go to England, it's not that bad. It's not perfect, but it's really not that bad. Obviously, you need to become better. So we kind of have the same situation in here. We had a really good understanding of how to grow the grapes, make the wine, but of course we didn't know enough, and the conditions are different. So it took us 2 or 3 years to kind of polish the grape growing, the right picking decisions, or some of the modification in the trellising system. But it's a fairly simple thing if you have some of the knowledge, the commitment, the passion, and you really want to succeed.
Well, you know, everything seems to be changing, however. I mean, with the climate change, I mean, I understand that it's affecting production in France. And, of course, I never thought I would live to see the day when I would be drinking champagne grown from grapes in England. And is there a lot of climate change going on in California?
Well, first of all, the climate is going to be, in the case of Albariño, for instance, we're talking about those two varietals, the climate in Galicia is going to be very similar to the climate we have in the Etna Valley. Albariño is a very coastal varietal that like to be grown close to the ocean. In the case of the Gruner Veltliner, it's in Austria, so it's much more continental than mm-hmm. here. It's a difficult question what you ask, because we do have variation of climate in California from year to year. In 2010 and 11, we had fairly cool year all the entire season. 2017 was one of the warmest year we had. So what we need to do now is kind of more adapt our vineyards to most likely warmer years. It looks like the last five years, we had warmer August, warmer September, warmer October, so we need to leave it a more canopy to protect the fruit from more heat, also sunburn. When you grow grapes, if you ever measure the temperature inside the berry, if the berry is outside the canopy versus under the canopy, there's a 15 degree Celsius difference in temperature. So if it's hotter outside, you obviously, and it's a varietal that doesn't like too much heat, you have a tendency to leave more canopy to protect the fruit to get less heat. And then when you're ready to harvest, if you have too much acidity because the acidity has not been reduced because the fruit was under in the shade, you may have to remove leaves a week or two before picking. So there's a little bit more canopy manipulation when you have more extreme variation of temperature. Mm-hmm. However, in the Etna Valley, being only 5.5 miles from the ocean, we have some of the heat spill we talked about, but less than probably than in other region, because really the ocean here around Santa Barbara to Monterey is at, you know, 60 degrees in summer, so it really acts as a buffer from excessive heat, because the water is fairly cool and there's always a wind blowing from the ocean into our vineyard.
Yeah, I remember when we were in Paso Robles, that in particular the Pinot Noir growers attributed their success in growing this rather finicky grape to the gaps in, if you like, in the range of coastal hills that allowed the cool air from the ocean to come in overnight and cool things down.
Yep.
And you're just verifying exactly the same thing. Now I wanted to go on and spend a little bit of time on the last of the three wines that we haven't talked very much about yet among the wines that you make, because we were actually going out to a French restaurant a few days after the bottles arrived, and I said, well, wouldn't it be a nice idea if we took a nice bottle of wine along to the chef who had just newly opened his restaurant? So we set off for a restaurant called Bar Frenchman with a Cabernet Sauvignon grown in California with butterflies all over the label.
Yep.
Tell us about, we loved this wine.
He liked it.
We really loved this wine. We were hoping to persuade him to put it on his wine list, and he might do that yet.
I mean, he's in the French wines. He wants his list to be all French wines. But he liked this wine.
This particular wine is, you describe, with all the beautiful, lovely butterflies on the label. It's called the True Myth Cabernet Sauvignon.
Right.
So this is the wine that is from Paso Robles. It's Cabernet. And the name True Myth is a name that came from the fact that we believe that Mother Nature is very important. She's surrounding us, and obviously butterflies are very delicate creature, very fragile, and but also absolutely beautiful. And we like to honor Mother Nature in the fact that all the wine that we make at the winery in the Etna Valley are sustainable. We're sustainable in practice. So what that sustainability means is we recycle every gallons of water. We now no longer using herbicides. We're using natural predators to get rid of some pests, to clean all the creeks, for instance, of weeds. We have now 60 goats, so we don't have to use herbicides that would kill salamanders and frogs. We have owl boxes all over the property to get rid of the rodents.
I'm so glad I got to know your company. I mean, you do all the right things.
We try to, you know, work with the ecosystem. So every year we rip half of the vineyards, and in November plant some barley seeds, legumes, peas, and let them grow.
When
spring comes, we mow the ground cover and disc it into the ground. So we kind of have an approach to be more gentle with Mother Nature, to make wine that are made from with less or no chemicals. It's really a desire to be more sustainable. It's something that I think you'll see more and more into the wine industry, and that's very important because it preserves the ecosystems that we have, and we limited an impact on nature. And I think more and more customers want those things. When you go to the supermarket today, you see a large section of organic product, and I think the younger generation certainly embrace those kind of new way of bringing food or beverage to the table.
Let me put it in a few words and see if you agree. It would seem to me that the Niven family wine estates people prefer making wine to making money.
Yes, we obviously need to make money because we
employees.
But it's the way to achieve earnings could be as different ways to arrive to it. One, you could be, once again, try to be more gentle about nature and try to do something that is more responsible versus simply looking at the bottom line, and that's definitely not what we're doing in here. We also have to realize this is a family business. We've been now growing grapes for 45 years. Right now, John Niven and Michael Blaney are the third generation. They plan on passing the company to their children, so really want to preserve what they have in terms of, you know, the vineyards, the land, not wasting water, you know, and then impact as little as possible the surroundings. So it's kind of it's a very long term. When you have family business, typically things are done generally in a better way, if I may say, because you don't have the pressure of rewarding the shareholders as much.
Right.
Well, Christian, I think you would probably agree it was a lucky day when you chanced upon this opportunity, and you're making the most of it. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm sure we'll our paths will cross again.
Well, thank you so much. It was truly a pleasure, Anne and Peter.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, we have, I think there's a resurgence of interest in rum, but I may be wrong.
Well, you remember we had Fred Minnick
on rum.
Talking about rum just a few months ago, and I think we've had another supplier on as well.
Yeah, well,
in fact, I think we had a domestic one.
Yeah, this one is turquoise, may I say.
Turquoise leaf. Life. Yeah, there you go.
Turquoise life. And we have unusual names, Tunch and Aylin Doker.
Now, still, Steeler fans will know the name Tunch because of a star from several decades ago, Tunch Ilkin, who's now a broadcaster, and they share the same heritage. They're both families originally from Turkey.
Okay,
so that's where Tunch comes from. But how they got to Colombia and representing fine rum from Colombia. Well, that's all part of the story.
Right.
Many, many times at On the Menu Radio, we get very pleasant surprises. We also get some not so good surprises. But one of the pleasant surprises recently was the arrival of a bottle. And we didn't even know it was coming. And the one thing about it that was interesting was that on top of the cork in the bottle was an eight, looking like the eight ball in billiards, on American billiards. And I wondered what was going on here. And then I figured it out that the eight represented the age of what was in the bottle.
Correct.
And Tunch and Island Doker were kind enough to send it to us. They represent this fascinating brand called Passé. And I'm just going to ask them to tell us what makes it so special.
Fire away. So I'm delighted to share with you about Passé rum, which I believe is one of the most unique expressions of premium rums. Now, we all know that in the Caribbean, a lot of countries are producing rum, and for hundreds of years, you know, people have been enjoying this nice brown spirit, and what I'm referring to is mainly the more premium, more aged rum. And this style of rum is not really designated for mixing. It's not sort of used mainly in cocktails, but rather is consumed either neat or on the rocks, and almost like a cognac. And we saw that this category was highly under-indexed in the USA, and we went out on a search looking for the best rum. And, you know, as I said earlier, every country is producing a very nice expression. Well, what we found with Passé is rather unique. First of all, it's coming from Colombia, and everything that's coming out of Colombia, especially these days, are very, very elegant, has a long history of tradition and culture, quite a unique place to go visit between their coffee culture and their wonderfully friendly people. We just found that to be a bonus.
Now, hold on just a second, Tunch. In the background material we got, it appears that the rum is finally blended in Colombia, but comes from other places in the Caribbean as well. Am I right there, or did I misunderstand?
Correct. The rum does come from a blend of various countries, specifically four other countries, and is brought to Colombia, where our master blenders
both Arthur and Brogen Fernandez blend this compilation of rums and age them. Most of the rum that is arriving is already aged, but what they do is something special. They age the bourbon, the rum in bourbon casks, so good old American casks that have been transported down to Colombia into the facilities, aged in bourbon casks. So if you pick up a bottle of Parse, you will see, and on the nose especially, this effervescence that comes out that is so particular. It's almost like a whiskey lover's or bourbon lover's rum, aged with fineness. And that is a very exceptional, especially as we look at the premium category. This distinction really helps stand out. It's not too sweet of a rum. It's not too harsh of a rum. It's very well balanced. And this age that Arthur and Brogen, the two master blenders, put together is such a refined expression of what rum can be.
Do you like the barrels associated with a particular bourbon, or is just any bourbon that's available?
Sure. It does come from Kentucky, and about 90% of the barrels were used for Jack Daniels.
Oh, okay. So it's really from Tennessee in that case.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Tennessee. I said Kentucky. Tennessee.
but watch out, we'll make enemies on both sides of the border.
Yeah, definitely.
We're not careful. It's interesting. Is it common to age in barrels that have had something else? I haven't heard of it before.
Right. Yeah, I've heard of a lot of bourbons that are aged in rum barrels to have a funky sort of effect on it, but not so much in the way that Arthur and Brogen are doing.
Now, the funny part about it is this rum has in common Scotch whiskey, which is also aged in used bourbon barrels. And there's been some experimentation going on with barrels that contain port and sherry, as well as the more common, which is bourbon barrels.
And there you go.
And the Scots are notoriously, shall we say, thrifty.
Yeah.
So we originally thought that they used bourbon barrels because they were cheaper than new ones. now this wouldn't. Parquet wouldn't have anything similar to that going on, would it?
No. So you said something interesting. This is Eileen. I just wanted to chime in here. There is a lot of innovation, especially in the craft premium world and spirits going on where, you know, and this is what the master blenders had in mind, to really give it a unique taste profile by aging them in these bourbon casks. And, you know, what we like to distinguish ourselves as is, you know, you're not going to replace your loyal bourbon drinkers or your loyal scotch or whiskey drinkers. This is something really unique that draws that audience that are loyal to their bourbons. But rather, it's more to complement their back bar. So it's something that's new. It's something that could stand up to what their taste profile is really looking for and what they crave on the palate. But it's something different. So Parse has really filled that category with the bourbon and the Scotch drinkers to complement their back bar with something really unique and different.
So I hear you're talking about the bar trade, which is constantly looking for new things to put in their concoctions, right?
Yes.
Absolutely. And I believe we found something that is certainly unique for them and certainly should be considered, especially as the rum premium rum category evolves. Every single bottle is actually handcrafted. And if you look at the back of a bottle, each one is hand-numbered with a signature. And, you know, within that craft segment, much to your point, Peter, you know, we're seeing a demand for a new the next best thing, something that has a great story, something that is unique, stands out. And I believe we, and something that is handcrafted, and I believe we've sort of captured each one of those elements with Parse Rum.
It's a very handsome bottle of that, there is no doubt. Now, one thing I noticed, I flipped through the recipes that are on your website, and something struck me that most of the cocktails that you have listed there included both the 8-year-old and the 12-year-old together.
Mm-hmm.
Together with some other things, and that struck me as interesting. I wondered why, if you knew why, or whether that's just what bartenders do.
Right. So we do have the 3-year-old, we do have the 8-year-old, okay, and we do have the 12-year-old.
Okay.
Every single drop of that in that bottle of the 3-year or the 8-year or the 12-year is aged in those bourbon barrels for the number of years that are designated on that bottle. So it is not done in a Solera system, but rather that each bottle is really aged that long. So each bottle is going to have a different expression, especially as you gain with the age. And the more I age, the more character and the more structure and body and the value that each one has. So it gets really funky, Peter and Anne, when you start sort of substituting different ages within the cocktail. My favorite cocktail is the old-fashioned using Parse 8 or Parse 12. Traditionally more of a whiskey or bourbon drink, you know, when you substitute with Parse 8 or 12, really, really amazing. If you want to go something more light, more funky, what we recommend is the Drabroni and the Dusk and Breezy. Really fun, very elegant, and certainly suits a lot of people's tastes.
These are different ones you mentioned are just different cocktails.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
Now, could I ask this? What exactly is Turquoise Life, or as I'm instructing my granddaughter, to Turquoise Life?
Yes, so that's the name of our company. So we are an importing and marketing company of wine and spirits. So that is the company that we built about 7 years ago. And under that company, we house all of these brands, including Parse. And if you'd like me to go a step further, the meaning behind Turquoise Life is really, you know, what inspired us to start the company, really just building and creating lifestyle beverage brands. So brands that revolve around a lifestyle where you can kind of close your eyes and picture yourself on the turquoise coast, on the Mediterranean waters, if you will, just sitting back and relaxing and sipping on one of our lifestyle brands.
But especially in the case of the things you deal with, you have one particular kind of wine that you specialize in that's sort of pink, right?
We do. So we have a lot of pink wine in our portfolio. Rosé wines, specifically coming from Provence, is really what we are known for and what we started the company on. And since then, we've become specialized in the rosé category and have been able to build our portfolio into these really interesting and innovative categories, such as rums, and coming from a unique part of the world like Colombia. So it's afforded us the privilege and opportunity to build a foundation, bring on other brands that really fit our lifestyle and our DNA for Turquoise Life.
Now, let's do something for our listeners around the world who puzzle over rosé wines. Because somebody told us once a long time ago that rosé is meant to be drunk no later than the year after it was made. So if you're in a fine restaurant or a not-so-fine restaurant and the sommelier offers you a seriously aged rosé wine, you don't want that.
Beg to differ on.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, in a yes. for probably, I would say, 98-99% of the rosés produced, yes, that does hold true, Peter. But for there are specialties, specifically in the Côte de Provence and Bandol regions. I believe there's a little element of ageability. And, you know, we, for example, with Vivité, this is our flagship brand, the winery in Domaine Sainte-Marie is located just 15 kilometers inland from Saint-Tropez and really embraces the Grenache grape. And on these, in this beautiful winery, you have 80-year-old Grenache vines that produce a splendid expression of what rosé can be. Because of these older vines, the tendency for ageability is much more, it has that aptitude. So I've recently tasted, it is late 2017, I've recently tasted a 2013 vintage as well as a 14, and they were holding its own. They were holding its own. There are those specialty wineries that allow ageability within rosé.
Well, thank you very much for clarifying that. That's very helpful. Thank you so much for bringing the story of Parçay to On the Menu, and we wish you continued good health. And I guess we say bottoms up or cheers.
Cheers to that, Peter and Anne. We are very grateful for this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers to you as well. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, we seem certainly to be running a roster of unusual names.
You bet.
Today. Next up, we've got Rachel DeTemple. Is that correct?
Yeah, and she's the name is originally French, although she's lived all over the place.
Oh yeah, she's a fascinating history.
A lot of the time in Texas, you'll get the whole story, and you'll wonder how one person could have packed that much into a lifetime.
Yeah, and you'll have to rush out and get this book, because at this time of the year, we could all benefit from its vital tonics and soothing teas. Rachel, you're going to have to pronounce your last name for me again.
Okay, it's DeTemple.
Thample.
DeTemple.
DeTemple, yeah.
DeTemple. Is that French? Or?
It is.
No, it's Americanized French. So I actually grew up in Texas. The name came from the French Alsace.
Okay.
And it got changed because I think it originated as a DeTemple. It would have been a area settled by the Knights Templar on the German border of France. And then it came to, my ancestors came to Pennsylvania, and from there it went from DeTemple to DeTemple. I don't know why. If you look up, I think anyone with my surname's related to me.
Yeah, there's not a lot of you.
No. But where in Pennsylvania were you? We're broadcasting from Pittsburgh.
Well, I wasn't in Pennsylvania. This is going back about 100 years. Then it migrated. The samples then went to Kansas.
Oh, I see.
And then my grandparents, for a short period, lived in California, and then they moved to Texas, and that's where my mother met my dad.
Funny place. Have you been? It's a funny place, Texas.
I grew up, and I was there until I was 18. I've been in London for about 21 years. I've been here longer than anywhere else.
Now, your book that we're going to be talking about is called Vital Tonics and Soothing Teas. Subtitled,
yes.
Traditional and Modern Remedies That Make You Feel Amazing. I am sympathetic to this whole concept because I believe in all this. I put turmeric in everything.
Yeah, no, it's lovely. I think you Yeah, you become addicted to it because it makes you feel good. It kind of like coffee makes you feel good, but it's having a more positive benefit overall. Not that coffee's bad for you, but in the quantity most of us drink it, it is not as good.
Here is the funniest thing. From when I grew up in England, and our family were not wealthy, not quite the opposite, in fact. And one of the things that most children had that we never got was pop, soda pop.
Yeah.
There was one particular flavor everybody loved called dandelion and burdock.
Wouldn't
you know,
Yeah, I've done a recipe in the book for that.
Exactly, I noticed it. I thought that was really interesting. I didn't realize when we were sneaking that it was really healthy.
in the version you had probably was healthy, but over time, even there's some upmarket brands selling it here, and you look in the back of the ingredients, and like a lot of those drinks, the color is coming from artificial coloring, and, you know, it's not as healthy for you. So I've done kind of a healthy version, but I did test it against the store-bought version to make it, you know, as close as I could without compromising on the ingredients. And I let my 11-year-old, he taste tested it, and he was happy.
Oh, good.
With the results. So.
What brought all this? Some kind of health condition or is it just something you always did?
No, well, it wasn't necessarily, although I have... I wouldn't say it's necessarily a health condition, but I did go start seeing, and I worked with a nutritionist on the book, and I started seeing her a few years ago because I was eating really well and not feeling as well as I should, eating lots of, you know, organic fruit and veg and, you know, making everything from scratch, and I still was feeling a bit sluggish and tired. So I went to see a nutritionist. One thing I wasn't doing right was sleeping, because I just thought it was a waste of time, and realized actually it's not. It's quite important.
It is.
And I've done some drinks in the book that address people who burn the midnight oil, and what happens is you erode your cortisol levels, and your body becomes completely out of sync because you're not giving it time to reboot itself. Just like I was sort of when my son tries to cheat sleep and sort of dodge bedtime, I tell him that it's like turning a computer off. You know, if you don't turn the computer off and let it restart, then it's going to overheat. And I think that happens to a lot of us. But another thing that was wrong with me was when I was a child, I was given lots of antibiotics and never given any probiotics. And so I found out I had no good bacteria at all in my gut, zero.
Oh, that's
and,
good.
So I had to repopulate it, and kefir was what I used to repopulate it, and it was quite scary at the start because it was like an explosion going off, this sort of battle of good versus bad bacteria. I had little patches of eczema as well, and once I'd sort of taken a three-week course of having kefir every morning. The dairy kefir is what I had. It was made with the goat's milk. And I was buying it in, too, which inspired me to make my own because it was quite expensive to buy in, especially having it every day for 3 weeks. But it completely changed the way I felt and cleared my eczema, which I'd had for about 15 years. And I just kind of thought it was this annoying thing. But it seemed to get worse and worse, and there were certain foods I started to relate it to. So if I had beer or too much wheat or too much sugar, then it would sort of, you know, get worse. And so I did this exclusion diet and did the kefir course, and it's completely solved the problem, really.
You know, we had a book, and we interviewed the author. The book was called... what was it called? Super... Heroes.
And okay.
Food super.
Something like that.
Food superheroes.
And all this.
Oh, that's a nice thing.
All this gut bacteria is all that.
I'm a firm believer.
Yeah,
they're the superheroes.
Quite a trendy topic now.
Yes, it is. But but the number one was turmeric. Number one superhero.
So we've introduced that into our diet. We put it in everything. We sprinkle it on cornflakes. Well, we actually don't.
we don't
really, because we don't eat cornflakes. But if we did.
Well, it's funny because I was trying to wean my mother off of Sprite, which she has not. She used to drink about 2 liters of Dr. Pepper a day. And then she switched to Sprite thinking it was healthier, maybe because it has lemon and lime flavoring. But I tried to make, and I thought it was pretty on par, so I always taste these things next to what I'm trying to get people to swap them with. And I made a water kefir with lime and lemon. I used essential oils because I tried it with fresh, and the flavor really varied. But with the essential oils, you just got consistency, and it was really easy to make. And she was trying it at the start. She was doing 50-50, Sprite and 50 kefir, and I just said that's actually not, they're negating each other. Basically, you're cancelling out all the benefits of the water kefir by putting all that Sprite in there. So she switched to the kefir, and she likes that now. So.
Did you try Mountain Dew?
Yeah.
Now, tell me some of your most favorite. I keep calling them superheroes, infusions, or what do we call them? I thought the Scarborough Fair tea sounded intriguing, because I used to do...
Yeah, it's really nice. It's funny, because I had it as an idea. Sometimes you kind of have this idea in your head, but you have to try it to make sure it works.
Uh-huh.
And that one I had in my head, but I wasn't 100% sure it'd work, and then I tried it, and it's really, really lovely. It's just... It's not totally savory. It sounds quite savory, but it does have this kind of medieval-y feel to it. But it's a really lovely herbal tea. It does have like a sort of masculine edge to it with the sort of sage and, you know, the woody herbs. But it's and the parsley actually gives it this lovely freshness. But it's a really lovely tea, and it's really, really good for you this time of year when the weather gets colder and people are starting to get the sniffles.
Well, you know, I have green tea every single day, and I like green tea with fresh turmeric in it.
Oh, that sounds really nice.
It really is nice.
I like one of my favorites. What I was drinking today is I was having one of the spice root teas, and I was having green tea with saffron and cardamom.
I was doing saffron for a while, but I didn't think about it. I saw that in your book, and I thought I could try that one next because we have cardamom.
Yeah, well, saffron's really good for you as well. I almost regret calling it a women's blend because I think then it makes it too exclusive. Although the intro does say men can have it as well. It's quite, it is kind of a girly tea, but it has, it's good for men and women. But the saffron, it has saffron in it as well. And, saffron's really... a really healing food. It helps
using that, but then Peter thought that it was getting a bit pricey.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Yeah, it can get a bit expensive. I've grown my own before in my window box. You can grow your own saffron, too. Yeah.
Well, you have to grow the
crocuses. Have to really keep an eye on it. It's easy to grow, actually. It's pretty effortless, and it's a plant. You know,
it's a crocus, isn't it? It's just a crocus.
So you just have to, as soon as they come out, you need to get the sort of stems from it. Yeah. Otherwise, because I had one that collapsed, because I hadn't even noticed that it bloomed, but luckily I was able to snap out the saffron before it was too late.
But you'd have to grow a whole bunch of them to get any impact out of them, huh?
Yeah, I mean, two flowers would give you enough for a tea. So, and they're really pretty. I think the key with it though is that it's such a quick turnaround. The flowers open and then they collapse and then they're done.
I think that's
the problem. It's not a continual harvest. It's once a year moment in time.
Well, now,
you have to be on it as soon as they open.
Something that's having its moment is this rye kvass.
Yes,
they use it.
Is it quite popular in the States then? At the moment?
Yes, big time.
Oh, that's interesting because you guys are way ahead of the UK in terms of sort of drink trends. Because every time I go to back home to Texas, they, I'll go to cafes or shops, and it'll, you know, you can try like 25 different varieties of kombucha, different kefirs. But I haven't seen rye kvass at in the shops. Definitely not here. But I love making it. I think it's a really good beer alternative. It's quite earthy and mysterious, and it gets a really nice carbonation, and you get that frothy foam at the top as well, like you do with a pint of beer.
Now why do you need a beer alternative, my dear?
Well, you don't, but
exactly.
If say you, I don't know, if you want a breakfast beer, perhaps.
Breakfast beer.
Or if you're trying to cut back on alcohol, you're doing some sort of detox.
Now, interestingly enough, your book out now. Does this mean that you'll be heading in this direction career-wise too? I mean, will you build a business around it, or?
Well, I mean, potentially. I have. I'm actually going to be sampling at my local market some of the drinks, products. So it's an idea that's brewing. Pardon the pun. But I definitely plan to come over to the U.S. and because that's where I started. It's funny because I've been here in the U.K. for so long, but I definitely would like to, to do more in the U.S.
I think you find a very receptive audience here. Actually, I think people are really into this.
You could go to Seattle. You could go to Portland, Oregon. You could go anywhere in California, and they would lap it up, if you'll pardon my pun.
And nut milks are big here now too. I mean, those in your book. You missed one that we've been introduced to lately, is macadamia nut.
Oh yes, I'm going to Australia for Christmas. I have a really good friend there, and she, I've worked with her. She does very similar things to what I do, and so she's a food writer over there, and she was she actually made me some when she was here. It's delicious. Right, actually I didn't include that. You can actually just keep going with the nut milks, because one I get in Texas often is pecan milk as well.
Where will you be in Australia?
I'm going to be mostly in Adelaide, but also
nice.
In Sydney.
Yeah, we used to live in Geelong, Melbourne. We were just there in March for the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival.
I'd love to go to Melbourne. It's hard to get around, isn't it? Because everything's so big.
It's
spaced out.
That's one misconception people have.
Well, if you're interested in going to Byron Bay, where they grow macadamia nuts,
that's what I was just going to tell her about.
If you are in a position where you want to do that. Shoot us an email, and we'll connect you up.
We have two plantation owners of macadamia nuts.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, so. That would be lovely. I'd definitely tell my friend, because she has a brand of products in Australia. So she heroes native Australian foods and has a brand of products called Warndu, and she travels all over Australia connecting with producers and making these amazing products.
Mm. Well, I mean, I envy you being there in 1 month.
I'm really looking forward to it. It's starting to get really cold here. It's going to be a very different Christmas.
Yes. Well, we wish you much luck with your book and with your business that you're going to be starting, and with your trip to Australia. And I'm glad that we met.
Yes, absolutely. No, me too. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rachel.
It's a pleasure.
And you'll never in your right mind imagine what's going to be the final track for today's program.
Well, now, remember that there's a possibility that there's a tie-in here, because it's a marshmallow bar or cafe, and basically what is hot chocolate without marshmallows, right?
Oh, okay. Is that what it is?
And isn't hot chocolate a beverage, right?
Oh, okay. So you managed to sling it together. I was just trying to figure out how we could fit them into the sequence.
Well, that's
of events.
It. So we're going to talk to Lindsay and Kat.
Lindsay and Kat from Chicago,
and a really wacky idea that turns out to be being real successful.
Now, who knew a marshmallow cafe? Now, that's an idea. And what color would you associate with a marshmallow cafe? Let's try pink. Is that correct, Lindsay Shanks and Kat Connor, the owners of this marshmallow cafe called XO, or is it Kisses and Hugs Marshmallows?
So this is Kat. Our company is called XO Marshmallow, and we own a cafe in Wonderland in Chicago. Our cafe and our brand colors are very, very bright. We call it our happy place. We do have pink. We also have mint green and sort of a tangerine orange color.
Wow.
So it really, there's color everywhere.
Now, you started off with a Kickstarter campaign, right?
This is Lindsay here. Yeah, that's correct. We've actually currently run two Kickstarter campaigns. We ran one the first holiday season that we were in business. We were using a tiny four-quart mixer. I mean, they don't even make those mixers anymore. So we ran a Kickstarter. Kat was calling it her Mom Needs a New Mixer campaign because we had such high demand for our marshmallows but too small of equipment to get it done. And then we ended up running a second Kickstarter in April of this year to help pay for our cafe in Wonderland. We're presented with a unique opportunity for the space that we are in, and we thought by running a Kickstarter, it would help us not only get the upfront funds that we needed to get the cafe off the ground, but it would help validate the idea that having a marshmallow cafe is something that people wanted, since so many people would be crowdfunding it, and we far and away surpassed our goal.
Now, where does the Wonderland part come in? Am I misunderstanding
it? Yes, this is Kat speaking again. Our Wonderland element is really taking the idea of marshmallows to the next level. The cafe side of things gives people a chance to come in. It's a kind of a smaller space. You can come and you can order things like s'mores, but you can also get anything from our full-service espresso bar. We've got a toasted marshmallow latte. We make hot chocolate. We make frozen drinks. And the Wonderland aspect is really all of the fun flavors that we have, everything from salted caramel to lavender honey to champagne, as well as the unique applications of our marshmallows and our OMG, which is our ooey marshmallow goodness. It's a marshmallow cream. So we utilize those in different ways. And then, honestly, you can buy any of our boxes or products online or in the retail part of our cafe and bring them home. And, you know, the idea is just that marshmallows can be used so many different ways, and it's really an opportunity to let your imagination run wild.
Now, do people just come to your shop and sort of hang out, you said, particularly on the weekend?
Yeah, this is Lindsay again. As Kat said, our cafe is quite small. We can comfortably fit about 16 people seated. One of the things we've noticed during the week, we're right next to a university, so we do have students that come in with their laptops and maybe get a little bit of homework done with a toasted marshmallow latte and a s'more, or we have students that come and do a lot of group meetups here on the week as well. On the weekends, it's everything from parents with their little kids to young professionals to all over the place, people both taking the marshmallows to go and sitting down. On the weekend, if you can find a seat, you're welcome to have a seat.
Yeah. You're lucky if you can get one, though, right?
Right.
Now, tell us, for those who've only found marshmallows on the supermarket shelf, what distinguishes your marshmallows from the commercial marshmallows?
Sure. Kat speaking again. Our marshmallows are all handmade in small batches right here in our kitchen, and we don't use any preservatives. So a lot of people have those store-bought marshmallows and say they're bland, they get quite hard, they sometimes taste very artificial, and that's the exact opposite of what our marshmallows are. They're light, fluffy. We infuse them with fresh flavors. So we make our own salted caramel sauce that we swirl in. We do a variety of actual fruit-based marshmallows. We have a strawberry and a raspberry. This summer we did a passion fruit marshmallow, and we're actually pureeing fruit into them. So on one hand, I think people are really surprised that a marshmallow could taste this delicious, And on the other hand, people are really excited because every time you come in, there's something new to experience. At the same time, our marshmallows toast really well, so you can make a s'more out of them. You can use them in baking. You can use our homemade marshmallow fluff in frosting, so they hold up really well.
Or you can do just what we did, and you can just pluck them out of the box.
Absolutely. You can just snack on them from
box to mouth.
and
if you want them to last a long time, they're actually just barely two bites.
Are you familiar with the ice cream museum?
Very familiar with the ice cream museum. It's one of those places, last time I was in L.A., I really wanted to visit, and, of course, the tickets were booked up for about a month.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking in terms of the direction you might go in, that you might do what the back business does. And I think they're now in five different cities, or four. Four different cities. So they're,
I don't think I even realized they had expanded so much.
Yeah, open up. I mean, I don't know how they do it. I mean, I guess they make their money off of tickets, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's sort of the business model you might take a closer look at. I mean, there are just so many marshmallows you can sell out of a 16-seat shop storefront in Chicago, right?
Being the only location we have isn't something that we want. You know, we don't think this will be our only location, if that makes sense.
Oh, sure.
We've just only been open since July.
Right.
Yeah, well, I think what you need to be discovered by a trio like the girls from Sex in the City, who single-handedly created a demand for cupcakes in Manhattan.
That's true, that's true. The creator of Sex in the City, a lot of people credit her for the success of a lot of cupcakeries and for the success of Jimmy Choo. So
yeah.
Who knows? Maybe they'll make a third movie and swing by here. Fingers crossed.
Well, I really wish you a lot of luck. It's your packaging is beautifully done. Now I understand a little bit about that, since one of you is a designer as well, right?
Technically, so this is Lindsay. So I design all of our packaging, and Kat and I work together to design the interior of the space. I actually have a master's degree in psychology, and Kat has a law degree.
good.
So neither of us is technically trained in either design or marketing
or
food, for
making.
That matter. We're just really passionate about it and enjoy what we do.
Yeah, you have no idea how many people we interview that have a change in career. Particularly outstanding are the chocolate makers. Chocolatiers. I mean, they're from every profession imaginable, like a high profile criminal prosecutors. I mean, it's just amazing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I have a sense that these marshmallows might be the next Cronut.
Wouldn't you wish? Huh?
Hey, if we could be as successful as Mr. Holmes, I'll take it.
Well, wasn't it Dominique Ansel?
Yes, Dominique Ansel.
We invented the Cronut, and we went to his shop in London, and you want to see what a crowd is like. a crowd of people tucking in on could-be marshmallows.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, lots of luck, Lindsay and Kat, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
And thank you for bringing us a whole new experience in, what are they called? Marshmallows.
Marshmallows. Yeah, I used to think they grew on bushes, but I mean,
somebody did that, didn't they?
I don't know.
I think somebody did that. There was a spoof, an April 1st spoof on a serious British television program called Panorama, which was a sort of like 60 Minutes, and they had spaghetti growing on trees. and somebody did the same with marshmallows, didn't they?
Somebody did it with marshmallows.
I thought so. Yeah, there you go. So maybe you need a tree outside, huh?
maybe that's what we should do for our Christmas tree in the cafe. We'll just stuff marshmallows all on it.
Oh, I think. I couldn't imagine you doing anything else.
Yeah, so when you do that, send us a picture and we'll put it on our website.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you, too, and good luck.
Okay, thank you
so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Seriously, listeners, we were trying to figure out how we could get the kitchen sink into this program, but somehow we failed. You'll have to wait and find out if we do it next week, same time, same place. So please join us then. And until then,
bye-bye.